Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. One of the themes that Ajahn Chah would emphasize over and over again would be the sense that our practice in Buddhism is not some sort of separate things in the sense of the practice of precepts, meditation, wisdom, that these are kind of separate things, or that the aspects of, in practice of say, tranquility and insight are separate things. We talk about them separately. They have different words, but they're integrated, or they work together. And he gave the example of they're like a mango, which the example works really neatly in Thai, because they have different words for, say, like a small unripe mango, which you'd eat it as kind of like a vegetable. And then for large green mangoes, which you'd eat in a different way with kind of salt and and chili, and then ripe mangoes. So that, you say, you've got, it seems like they're different things, you treat them in different ways, but they're the same mango. So similarly, the practice of the path of training in virtue, training in meditation, training in wisdom, they're different aspects, but they're part of the same path, they're part of the same training. They have to be integrated. They work together, they rely on each other. Similarly, he'd give an example of just something simple like pouring water from a vessel, where you start to pour and it starts to drip, and then it as you tip it a bit more, then it starts to flow a bit more, but the stream is still pretty small or not so constant. And then when you sort of tip it fully, then it's a full kind of flowing stream of water. And similarly in practice, where we when we begin, we're still maybe fumbling a bit. Our precepts aren't so steady, our meditation isn't so consistent, wisdom isn't so clear, But as we continue to practice, as we continue to train, as the flow of practice becomes more consistent, then that sort of that stream of mindfulness, the stream of knowledge, the stream of understanding becomes more consistent, more full, in the same way that when we're pouring water, that stream of water becomes more full and consistent. So this aspect of recognizing the integration of the training, integration of practice, not separating them out too much, recognizing how they rely on each other, that we keep the precepts in order to train and understand the nature of how we create problems, create difficulties, create suffering for ourselves. We train in meditation and mindfulness so that we can understand more clearly how we create agitation, create a sense of conflict in our own mind, how we create it in relationship to others, and how we can develop calm and tranquility, similarly with wisdom. It's not as if there's this blazing insights come and you get sort of the understanding of the nature of reality just sort of rolls out in front of you. It's a gradual process that we begin to get a more clear understanding of ourselves, of our own foibles, of how we can relinquish that, how we can, what the nature the nature of the world around us is, the nature of the mind. We gradually gain insight and understanding into this. So it's a gradual path, it's an integrated path, and it also has a purpose, it has a goal. And that's there's a discourse where the Buddha talks about the practice or the purpose of the teachings is not, say, it's not for the benefits of generosity and goodness, it's not for the benefits of virtue and having precepts, it's not for the benefits of peace and tranquility, it's not for the benefits of wisdom and insight, but it's for the sure heart's release. Doesn't mean that there isn't any of those benefits that arise. They do arise. They have a motivating influence in our practice, in our life. But there's a goal in the end, or there's a purpose for all of it, because it integrates together for the heart to be truly released, to be free. Now that to be able to pay attention to these different parts of the practice, parts of the training, recognize that there are these benefits that do arise, but also keeping one's eye on the goal, keeping one's eye on the sort of the purpose. Because if we don't know how to integrate, we don't have a sense of that integration, then one, we get, say, caught or fascinated by different aspects, depending on our temperament, depending on our own kind of biases or our own fears or our own kind of our own prejudices. You know, there's different people get very fixated on kind of rules and the purification through conduct, and again, that's not bad in itself. But if that's all we fixate on, then we're gonna miss the whole picture, or the delight in generosity or the devotional aspects of a practice, which brings tremendous joy, brings tremendous faith, and that's a great thing to be attending to, cultivating. But it's also, how is it integrated? How do I integrate that into the other aspects of the training? How do I see it in it and rely on it so that it supports practice and doesn't become a distraction? The same with meditation. I mean, it's so often you hear in people talking about Buddhism, particularly in the West, and Buddhism is equated with meditation, as if it's another kind of meditation technique. That Buddhism is some kind of sitting. And sometimes there's certainly people around that it's, and meditation is, you know, narrows down to like that. It's just, you know, sitting. There's sitters around. And it is, and it's not as if you can actually, say, realize the goal of practice without the meditation. But again, it's how is it integrated? How does it function to enhance the whole path? How does it fit in so that it supports the other aspects of training, and how does meditation itself, how does that work? Because it can become just a technique, and certainly Ajahn Chah would be always trying to emphasize the necessity of bringing meditation into everything that we do. That meditation was about sitting, walking, standing, lying down. All the four postures. It's something that we have to learn how to carry into, bring into all of the aspects of our day-to-day life. And of course, this, when we do formal sitting meditation, sort of the clearer we can become, the more still we can become, the more that stillness and clarity comes into our the things that we do, how we engage with others, how we engage with our work, how we engage with people, so that there's it isn't isolated. The meditation isn't isolated. And the aspects of wisdom are, you know, it's easy to, especially in Buddhism, it can be extraordinarily seductive in terms of the philosophical and intellectual kind of structures that that are there in the teachings, and it can be, one can. It can be very satisfying to learn all these different kind of philosophical takes on things. Having everything sort of down pat in terms of logical and epistemological kind of structure, but again, that isn't what Buddhism is for. That isn't what the path is for. You have to. It's helpful to be able to bring some rigor into our kind of. Sometimes our flabby intellects and just sort of aren't kind of willing to sort of question or really reflect and investigate, but it's helpful to that extent that we do bring some rigor into how we reflect, how we investigate, how we challenge our assumptions, but. In the end, it's not just to have all the pat answers. It's to be able to see things more clearly and to be able to let go, to relinquish, and to put down. So that this path is one of integration and again, Ajahn Chah, here's some of his images are so apt. As of course, is a very well-known image of that he used of just the still flowing water. He says, yeah, most people know water when it's still. They know water when it's flowing. But they don't know still flowing water. He says, and so really that's what we're practicing for, is to be able to have this quality of still flowing water. And he said, and it's like, he said, because it's like we tend to know the mind when it's still and peaceful, or want to achieve that. That stillness, that peacefulness, that tranquility, so that we don't have to be agitated or irritated by our wandering minds. Or we tend to know the mind when it's thinking, reflecting, pondering, doubting, conceiving, conceptualizing, when it's moving. We know that. And whether it's thinking and pondering with foolishness or wisdom and intelligence, it's still moving. And we tend to go along with that. But to be able to have them integrated so that the stillness of the mind and the movement of the mind are seamless, are working together, are accomplishing their goal, and the goal being freedom. So that there's a quality of peace within the movement. There's a readiness to reflect or a readiness to move within the stillness. The mind, that's a very dynamic quality. And you know the kind of the base for all of that is this awareness, is mindfulness. There needs to be that underlying mindfulness and awareness and clarity, knowledge, attention, whether it's within our keeping of precepts or the acts of generosity, kindness, of meditation, of discernment, and underlying that is always the foundation is built from the qualities of mindfulness. And so that really learning how to bring our mindfulness and awareness into all of the things that we're doing. So that that awareness is it's not it's not hard, because one of the things that we, when we try too hard, try too hard to be mindful, try too hard to be aware, try too hard to keep our precept, try too hard to keep our meditation together and all of that. They say that there is this kind of hard edge to the mind, and it's uncomfortable. We're not at ease. So that learning how to be at ease with putting forth effort into our practice, into our applying the principles. And that's where there's a necessity for, relying on a quality of loving kindness. And it's a fundamental attitude of the mind and how we apply the mind, so that there's this sense of openness, well-wishing, kindness, both towards ourselves as well as to others, so that the effort that we make can then be sustained. Because without it, if there's this, if there's a hard edge to the how we deal with the mind, how we hold the perceptions in the mind of ourself, our practice, the world around us, it gets tiring, and there is this underlying dissonance and discontent that will come into the mind. But there's the quality of loving kindness is there's a sustaining quality to that, in the sense that the mind is nourished in practice. And you think of the examples of the example of the Buddha. Now, how did the Buddha deal with situations? And over and over again, you come to these extraordinary acts of loving kindness, and because in some circumstances, this is extraordinarily formidable being, and the kind of incisive way that he can approach a problem and not sort of really brook any messing around, the bar is raised pretty high for the standards of conduct and training, that and whether it was for the monastics or for the lay community, really raised the bar of spiritual practice in India at his time, and through that even to this day. And but still, you go back to how the Buddha approached certain situations and said, well, there's this extraordinary loving kindness as well. And I think maybe as an extreme example, how the Buddha dealt with Angulimala. Now, here you have a serial killer. And not even in the tens, but he's getting up to his thousandth victim, and the Buddha goes to say, well, this is somebody who is worthy of teaching, worthy of approaching, and he doesn't challenge him, doesn't sort of go there and berate him and tell him what sort of level of hell he's going to have to deal with because of all his misdeeds. But he just approaches him knowing that Angulimala is going to sort of take after him. And he's just sort of walking calmly along, but using his powers to kind of be just out of reach of Angulimala, so that Angulimala is sort of pelting along, trying to catch up to him so he can, he's got his sword raised, he's going to kill him. And yells out to the Buddha, stop, Sangha. And the Buddha says, I'm the one who stopped, you're the one who hasn't. And that was a cause for Angulimala to kind of reflect and say, what? These religious seekers tend to speak truth. What does he mean? And the Buddha, and he says, well, I've stopped all killing, all harming, all violence. You are the one who hasn't stopped. And that was just, that was enough to, that kind of kindly pointing that out, and planted the seed for Angulimala to ask to receive teachings, ask to train under the Buddha. And then he took robes, lived under the Buddha, trained, and had some realizations. So that Angulimala himself, what that drew out was this tremendous loving kindness, even after being a murderer. And that there's one time Angulimala went on alms round, and there was a woman who was giving birth, difficult birth, and he was very disturbed by that. He was on his alms round. He knew the family. And he was just very disturbed by that, and went and asked the Buddha if there was anything he could do. And the Buddha said, well, what you can do is go and make an asseveration of truth and say that, make this, that since I have been born, I have never harmed a living being. By this asseveration of truth, may you and your baby be well. And he said, how can I say that? That's a lie. I've led a terrible life. And he said, well, then it has to be, he said this way, since I have been born in the noble birth, since my entering of the stream of the Aryas, that I've never harmed a living being, which he said, oh, I can say that. That's really true. And Angulimala went and said that. Made this resolution, aditana, satya aditana, resolution of truth, sincerely wishing to the well-being of this mother and her child. And immediately the baby was able to be born, and the mother was well. So through that strength of the loving kindness, the strength of the truth, that desire to help, to bring well-being into the world. So that these are qualities that help ourselves when we're able to bring forth that intention and clarify that wish for well-being, both towards ourselves, towards others. It really helps the practice, and it helps in ways that sometimes we don't even maybe recognize or conceive very clearly. But certainly for the mind to actually really settle in peacefulness, to unify, to become steady, that quality of loving kindness needs to be very, very strong. Not in a conceptual way or like you're sitting there repeating over and over again, may everybody be happy, may all beings be well. But you only use those phrases to trigger and support the kind of the emotional tone, the feeling in the heart. And so that to attend to that underlying feeling of well-wishing, of kindness, of gentleness, of openness. And you find that the mind becomes more settled, more peaceful. Now, as there is that quality of loving kindness, that is the kind of the feeling tone of the mind, as we allow that to help the mind to settle, it also breaks down a lot of the kind of barriers in the mind where we're kind of we get fixated on ourselves, we get fixated on how am I doing, am I getting ahead, am I going to get some insight out of this, what am I going to get out of this, doubts that inevitably arise, kind of wavering, worrying, those tendencies are really undermined just through the quality of loving kindness. It helps the mind to see through that, because it's that kind of fixation on self and sort of me and my practice, me and my progress, me and my attainment. What am I getting? What am I not getting? and just you're practicing for practice sake. You're practicing because it's the kindest thing to do for yourself and for all beings. It's just the way it is. So that ability to set aside, to drop, to relinquish, to not glom onto that sort of that me and my practice. It's very fostered through that quality of loving kindness. And again, it's a feeling tone that underlies. So to attend to that, recognize that is an integral part of this practice as well. That when we're talking about integrating the path, integrating all these facets of the path, that's a very strong integrating factor, and it helps to say that for the say helps it to gel, helps it to come together. So in terms of the practice, I mean there are many facets that we need to attend to, we need to develop, but also recognizing that it does have a point of unification, it does have a point, it does have a purpose, it's going somewhere. And then to be keeping keeping And that's if you're, and just in a Bhayagiri, where you're, if you're out walking on the trails or coming down to the hall here, and you have to keep a good watch on the foot in front of you, because it's a long drop in many places, and there's many different trails that you can sort of wander off and end up on the loop trail and going around the whole mountain. I want to get down to the hall. So you know that's where you want to go. So keeping an eye on your steps right in front of you, but also keeping an eye on where you want to go. So in practice, you want to learn how to be attentive to all these different aspects of the practice of the training, but it also remembering that it's got its goal, it's got a purpose, and that's the Buddha emphasizes in many places. It's that sure heart's release, freedom from suffering, freedom from the limitations of the mind, the heart that keeps looking for more problems for itself, that there is a way out. So I'll offer that for reflection this evening.
Andamayam dhamma tatayu sadukaram dhamma se sadu.